Well, I've been saying that Hosea represents God, and Gomer, this prostitute that he's told to marry, represents Israel, God's people. And here in Hosea 5, you read in verse 4, their deeds won't allow them to turn to their God, for the spirit of prostitution is within them, and they don't know Yahweh. I'm afraid that Gomer is presented as a woman who was sexually addicted. She had the best husband in Hosea, just like Israel did in God. And yet she goes off to all these different men. She gets pregnant and has a baby and tries to kid Hosea that this is your baby. And he says, no, this is not my people. This is not one of mine. And she goes further than that. And you see this theme developed in Ezekiel, where Israel are called worse than a prostitute in that she does not simply do it for money, as I suppose most prostitutes do. She does it because she's sexually addicted. She runs here and there to every possible different man, and worse than that, she actually uses Hosea's money and the things that he gave her in order to get men to sleep with her. She pays men to sleep with her, and this is why the prophets elsewhere say that Israel are contrary, that they absolutely were awful, that they were not only prostitutes, but they actually did the opposite. They paid men to sleep with them. And of course, that's referring to the way that they gave money to various other powers to come and be their protection, instead of trusting in Yahweh, their God. And so the sexual addiction of Gomer is reflective of how the people of Israel, the people of God, were addicted to other idols. They were addicted to so many different gods. And again, the other prophet makes the point that normally a nation have their own God, whereas Israel were different. They had Yahweh, but they didn't just have one God. They had any and every God they could get hold of. And that's why when the Babylonians thought that the people of Judah had made a deal with them to accept their gods, they were furious when they actually got to the temple and found it full of every possible kind of idol, all manner of different gods, different nations. And so the problem is with sin, that it is by its nature addictive. And this is what happened, that she became addicted, in her case, to sex in the same way as people get addicted to sin, to the point that their deeds, verse 4, won't allow them to turn to their God, for the spirit of prostitution is within them. So she was unable to turn to her God because of a spirit, because of an attitude, because of a mindset. So even if she wanted to come to God as she should, she couldn't because she had this addiction problem, this psychological problem. And it sums it up, they don't know Yahweh. Now, to know God in the Hebraic sense is not to know stuff about God as much as to have a relationship with God. So God does not judge people, I think, in terms of individual acts of stellar devotion to him or pathetic failure. The issue is your overall spirit. Now, I'm not by saying that minimizing sin, nor minimizing great acts of commitment and devotion. But in the end, life is not made up of those things. It is made up of relationship with God, and that is what God sought from his people and still does above all things. So verse 11, because he is obsessed in his pursuit of idols. Again, the language of obsession. This is the language of addiction. So then they were addicted to idolatry. And in Hosea 7, again, you got the similar language that they burnt in lust. And as I say, it's not in one sense that we should be fazed about individual isolated acts of righteousness, nor of sin. But when it comes to sin, the problem is that sin does get a psychological grip upon people. And the only way to counter that is to take on the psychology of God, to take on a new pair of eyes. And that is exactly what God is offering people in the Holy Spirit. But God will not force that upon people. You've got to want it. And you've got to want to know or to have this relationship with him. And the problem was that this addiction to sin led them to sin in every part of their lives. That is the great teaching of the offerings in Leviticus, that the animal had to be split up. The animal represented the offerer, and that's why Paul says in Romans, let us offer ourselves as living sacrifices, as whole burnt offerings, which is our logical service, that we should see in those sacrifices ourselves. And the animals had to be split up into all their various parts, and those inner parts, particularly attention was paid to the inner parts, the innards of the animal, they had to be put on the altar. The idea is that Christianity or relationship with God cannot be just in some aspects of our lives. It cannot just be part of our life. This has got to be the driving passion that affects absolutely every part of the human psychology, behavior, the innermost thought pattern, the most basic core definition of a person. And that's why the apparently small secret things are often focused upon by God as sort of eliciting his wrath, because they are symptomatic of the overall failure of the person to accept his way. It's not that God gets mad just about little things. It's that those little things are symptomatic. So in verse 10, the princes of Judah are like those who remove a landmark, and I will pour my wrath on them like water. Well, under the old covenant, each family had their allotted portion within the land, and they were told, therefore, you must not remove the landmarks. Now, to remove a landmark would be something that was done secretly, something that was done in the hope that it wouldn't be noticed. And each time the bad Israelite moved the landmark, it wouldn't have been that far. It would have just been a little bit into the neighbor's field, just a little bit at a time, so it wasn't noticed. But that individual act of just moving the landmark a little bit one night, maybe when the other family were away, or maybe the ownership of the land was in the hands of an old person who wouldn't quite notice, those little attempts to expand wealth at someone else's expense in a very petty sort of way, this elicited God saying, I will pour out my wrath on them like water. And so, as I say, it's not that God is cranky about little things. It's that those little things he sees as symptomatic of a person's whole direction in life. And so Hosea 5 goes on talking about how Ephraim went to Assyria and sent to King Jareb. This is referring, I think, to how Menahem in 2 Kings 15 gave 1,000 talents of silver to Pul, and Hoshea appealed to Shalmaneser in the same way a little bit later. And she sent to King Jareb, it says in verse 13, this is the equivalent of Gomer, we're told, going to her lovers and giving them money. And so, verse 15, I will go and return to my place until they acknowledge their offence and seek my face. In their affliction, they will seek me earnestly. Well, I think those sorts of statements are really the divine hope. This is what God hoped for. It was not so much as a prophecy. It was God's, if you wish, fantasy that they would say this one day. And I explained on chapter 2 that Hosea had these kind of fantasies, as I've called them, for Gomer. She was such a terrible woman, such a terrible wife, and yet he lived in the hope that one day they'd sort it out. And he has this fantasy in chapter 2 of her remarrying him as God wanted to with Israel, offering them a new covenant, a new deal, a new start, seeing they had broken the old covenant. And he fantasizes about an open-air wedding ceremony where him saying, I do, to the woman and her saying, I do, is like a voice that echoes between heaven and earth and the animals and the natural creation join in the joy of the whole event. That was the hope. And Hosea's hope for Gomer, it goes on to the end. You see it right in the very end of Hosea. And that represented God's undying hope, really, for Israel. And yet, what happened? I mean, did they return to him? No, they didn't. And so he moves on to a new people in the end, and that's you and me. And so, again, we have the challenge to be his faithful woman, to look at the way that Israel behaved and to feel awful that they who had our nature, who were humans like us, could behave in the way they did. It's like sometimes I look at men who abuse women and I'm ashamed to be a man. And I know Cindy, my wife, has passed the same comment to me. We come across a really worthless woman who's really messed up and abused a good man, that she said, I feel ashamed to be a woman. And I see a woman like that, and you know, that's how I feel about what some men make me feel. And so when you look at how Israel treated God, you do feel kind of ashamed to be human, in the same way as when you think about the crucifixion of Jesus, you sort of feel the same. And yet, what are we? We are human, and that's who we are. And we are called to be his faithful woman, not to be like Israel, not to have this sexual addiction, but to have a new spirit and to let him give that to us.